Welcome to Spoiler Peace Theater, the podcast that doesn't give a shit about spoilers. We just want to talk about the movies. My name is Evan Crean. I am co-chair of the Boston Online Film Critics Association and co-author of your 80s movie guide to better living, and my pronouns are he, him.
And my name is Megan Kearns. My pronouns are she, her. I write film reviews for Edge Media Network, and I too am a member of the Boston Online Film Critics Association.
That is true. You are.
Hashtag facts.
Yes. I'm filling the Dave spot this week with the comment after.
I know, because he's not here.
I know. Dave's taking a couple of weeks off from the show. We miss him, and we'll be happy to have him back. But in the meantime, you get Megan and me, and we're happy to be here, and we're excited to talk about this week's movies.
Yeah, we are.
Woo! Woo-hoo. Before we get into those, first want to say that over on our Patreon this week, our Patreon exclusive audio, we are talking about the 2010 Disney animated film Tangled, which was a lot of fun. Yeah.
Love
Don't talk about animated films that often, so we were excited to talk about that one. One of us had not seen it before. I won't spoil that, but if you're a patron, definitely check that out. And if you're not a patron, consider joining. You get access to exclusive audio like this episode, and there's something like 200 plus bonus episodes that you also gain access to, where we mostly talk about older films and occasionally some new stuff and other random bonus content. But for this week's show, we've got two movies for you. We're going to be talking about Good Madam and Don't Make Me Go. And we're going to start by talking about Good Madam. Good Madam is directed by Jenna Kato Bass? Unclear. And it's written by, oh my, several people. Too many to list right now. It has 11 writing credits. That is a lot of people.
That is a lot.
This is a South African horror film, and I'll give you the IMDb summary. We've got an eerie psychological thriller about Sidi, who is forced to move in with her estranged mother, a live-in domestic worker caring obsessively for her catatonic white madam in the wealthy Cape Town suburbs. But as Sidi tries to heal her family, the specter of Madam begins to stir. Yeah, that sounds very ominous, right?
It does.
And honestly, I think a lot more ominous than the movie turned out to be for me. But I'm curious what you think, Becca.
Sorry. Yeah, I found this really eerie and unsettling and uncomfortable. Yeah, I mean, I think it was interesting. You know, first CD starts seeing the dead dog. She doesn't know it's a dead dog, but she sees a dog. And then her mom's like, that dog died ages ago. It's like, uh-oh, there's some ghost shit happening.
Right,
like,
yeah.
Immediately, kind of like right out of the gate. Like, yowza. And then she's choking on her toothbrush and there's blood in the sink. And then we come back to that later in the film. And then I actually gasped when her hand fell off her wrist. Like her hand fell off and then her hand crawls away.
Yeah, that was creepy. That was creepy as heck.
Yeah. Yeah, that was. And like I kept waiting for more things to happen in her mouth than with the toothbrush because that it just kept coming. Yeah. But I'm sorry. I don't know why, Evan. You keep making me laugh, but you do. You're not even doing anything. But yeah, so I get what you're saying, like about how it sounds more ominous on paper. I think for me, though, I think the mood and the ambiance and the creepiness of the house, and I don't necessarily mean the house looked that creepy, but because it didn't. No. But there was a vibe going on, and I think it had to do with the score, the kind of chanting music that was going on, and the sideways and sometimes upside down camera angles. And I think the actress who plays CD, her facial expressions were quite good, like as far as being, you know, surprised or disturbed, things like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I had this vibe going, like, what's going on? What's going to happen? And I definitely kept thinking it's got to be a ghost story because it's got to be this haunted house because we're seeing a dead dog and there's a creepy body of the white lady upstairs, Diane upstairs. And I kept wondering, like, what's going on? But yeah, but a lot of international horror films seem to deal, like, a lot, and not that American ones don't either, but a lot deal with ghost stories or hauntings. And so that felt very much in alignment with other global horror cinema, and especially looking at apartheid, or, you know, apartheid had just ended in this film when it's set. And so, yeah, there's some really fascinating things happening. I feel like I'm rambling kind of all over the place because it's kind of how my experience was watching this film. And that sounds like an insult, and I don't mean it that way. I actually really did enjoy this and found it really fascinating, especially with the depiction of race and, you know, domestic servitude, and that they're black women. And then at the very end of the film, Diane's family is calling from Australia to check in on her, and they're like, oh yeah. And this is the first time we've seen kind of outside of the house. Everything else has been taking place in the house. And the family in Australia, the white family, is like, oh yeah, yeah, she's, you know, mom's fine. Mavis has got it under control. And then we see, you know, kind of out of the corner of our eye, you know, a black servant who is taking care of them. And it's like the cycle just keeps repeating. And yeah, so I think there's some interesting ideas here. I do have to say, not that you can't explore racism and racial justice and all of those themes from, not that white filmmakers can't, but I do wonder what this would have looked like if it was made by a black filmmaker and not a white filmmaker. And that's one thing I kept wondering. And not that it has to be, it certainly doesn't have to be a black filmmaker, but I think it would have brought another perspective. Although from what I read with an interview with the director, it does seem like, speaking to why there are so many writing credits, I think it's because it was written collaboratively with the cast. So, gotcha. So they clear, and it's almost an entirely black cast. So, and it's spoken in the Xhosa language. So clearly they gave input. So clearly it is getting their perspectives, which I have to say, if you are a white filmmaker and you are telling a story like this, the best thing you can do is get input from your cast. And I love that they, you know, did get their perspectives. So anyway, those are my rambling observations from the film. Good God. Evan, what did you think?
I wish I liked this movie more. For an hour and a half, I found this incredibly slow, painfully slow. Like, I couldn't believe how slow it felt for an hour and a half. I liked the ideas here. I liked this house. I liked the ideas of exploring race and class, particularly within the lens of South Africa.
Yes.
Like seeing the juxtaposition in the beginning of like the kind of like small kind of huts in like, you know, one part of South Africa in this like very posh, rich, you know, suburban area where like white women are out jogging, and you know, they see Seedy and like turn and like look at her like, oh, what's she doing here? She's out of place in this neighborhood.
Right.
Where everyone lives behind like a gate with like a buzzer, and you know, so I liked the ideas here. I don't know that it really, for me, successfully explored them in any kind of compelling way. There were parts where it felt like the ghosts story supernatural-ish elements were starting to like overshadow whatever we were trying to like get at with some of those other pieces, like the shocking parts you mentioned, like the like body horrors stuff. I was like, well, this is cool, I like this, but maybe in another movie. This feels weird that we're like circling some type of like weird body horror hallucination dark magic thing going on. Just to me, it felt kind of out of place. What else? What am I going to include in my ramblings here? the sound editing was really well done with the like lots of scrubbing, sink dripping.
Yes. Oh my God. I've never heard scrubbing, like the scrubbing of a floor, get my like goosebumps going as much as in this film. It's so good.
So eerie. Like they made, you know, housework seems so unsettling, and so I have to give the movie props for that, for making like floor scrubbing and like dish doing into something that just like makes me uneasy.
I know, teeth brushing. I'm obsessed with the teeth brushing. Good God.
Oh yeah, that scene. So ugh.
And that juxtaposed with the floor scrubbing, and then she is scrubbing the floor with her toothbrush. I'm like, anyway.
Yeah. Some of the characters, maybe you could help clear some of the stuff, because some of the character relationships were a little bit confusing to me. So like there was the guy who was her brother or her half brother that like Diane took care of. Did she raise him? Like he lived there in her house, but like it was very confusing, like how he tied into it, what his exact relationship was with Diane, like why he was kind of like so protective of her.
Oh, you mean, and now I'm looking for his name.
They called him Stuart, was like his like English name.
Yes, and then but I it's like Gwynka, it's like GWC.
Something, yes.
Yeah, yes. So that is a great question, and I'm not entirely sure. But he also, I thought, called Mavis his mother too. So right. I thought that Mavis was his mother, and that he was the sibling to Seedy. Yeah, yeah. So, but maybe he called Diane his mother too because he lived there. I don't know.
Like it seemed like she like kind of like bankrolled him, because like he came and he was like mostly speaking English and had like this fancy car, and they were talking about like, oh well, we should call him to like get his input on this, because it seemed like he had a relationship that was more personal with Diane, and the, like she kind of, I don't know if it was so much that she just like bankrolled his education and stuff, or if she actually played any type of maternal role. It was. That's the thing that bothered me, is I felt like some of the character relationships were just like unclear to me in watching what was going on.
Yeah. Well, I also was one, and it's, I'm glad you brought that up, because there were certain words that were said and certain things that I'm like, if I spoke Xhosa, would I understand this relationship better? Like, is this a word that's used to mean, like you could say like aunt, but it actually means like, this is my aunt on my father's side, and so on and so forth. So yeah, so there were certain instances that I was wondering that. And I was wondering, is there kind of a cultural and language disconnect, because I don't speak language. So I didn't know if that's why it was confusing, the relationships, or if it was confusing because the film didn't clarify it. So I'm glad you brought that up, because there were relationships that I'm like, wait, I'm not sure how these people are fully related. Yeah. So I mean, I'm glad you said that. But also I'm wondering, because I'm thinking, I'm also thinking like maybe it's because he did live there, because Seedy talked with her daughter about how she was there so often as a kid. So so maybe he did see Diane as kind of like a mother number two. I don't know.
Right, because there were those pictures of him when he was a kid, like grinning. And then there were like pictures of him on the walls, and they moved into his room because they didn't want to stay with Mavis. They didn't want to stay with her. They wanted their own space. So then they were in his room.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting talking about like it is interesting thinking about how Seedy kept saying to her mom, you know, you're acting like apartheid is still happening. Like you can't use Diane's, you know, glasses, you can't use her cups and things like that. But yet we're seeing Stuart in all the pictures with other white people. And like, so it is interesting, like, was he more incorporated into the family that way? But yeah, but then there is another element too, when Mavis keeps talking about like, we need Diane because we have nowhere else to go, which is really heartbreaking that Mavis has to keep being, you know, a housekeeper and a caretaker to her in order to live, you know, in order to have not just an income, but a home. And so but I'm also wondering if there's another element too. Like, does she feel like she owes Diane? Because she kind of sounds like she does because of his education. Yeah. So there's a lot of things that are not necessarily clear, but it's definitely raising a lot of these issues and hinting at a lot of things, which I think is mm-hmm. is fascinating.
And did you understand why they needed to kill him? I didn't understand why what happened with that either. That was all very confusing to me too. And I feel like it's not like I'm not paying attention to the movie. I don't know if it was a language barrier or if the film, like you said, the storytelling wasn't clear or some combination of it. I just didn't quite understand what was going on there either.
I don't know if I'm correct, but my interpretation was that he was the one pulling the strings, essentially, that they needed to sacrifice CD in order to keep Diane alive or something. I don't know. Mm. But because they're talking behind the door saying like, well, we just need her hands. And then CD's kind of like in this trance and offering up her hands. So that's kind of I think it had to do with that spell. Like, right. But I'm not entirely that, like, sure Egyptian... what was going to happen. Like,
yeah, because there was that whole like idea of like the Egyptian right. like afterlife yes. and like yep. the spell that makes someone your like slave in the afterlife or something like yes. that.
Yep.
And it was like, was the spell just on her hands? Is that why her hands were out of control? There's we're asking a lot of questions this week on the show. Yeah. This is not usual for us. Normally we have a better grasp of what's going on in the movie that we're talking about.
Yeah, but it is kind of interesting thinking about the Egyptian element, because they did bury their, like, if somebody died, like if a pharaoh died, they buried their companion animals, their servants, their spouse, mm-hmm. like everybody died along with them and was buried there too. Like it was like a mass suicide. Well, not really suicide, mass murder.
Right.
And so was that what was happening too? Because when CD is going through the cemetery, it's all people who were servants and it says forevermore. But yeah, so I can only hint at things. Like I can only, like, that's my interpretation, that mm-hmm. it was going, that spell was going to make CD a servant forever. But I feel like somehow also have something to do with Diane living longer or something. I don't know.
Right.
But yeah.
And then it seems like after sure. that, and then it seemed like after that we see Diane and she's like laying in like Mavis's like bed now. It's like, did she get like demoted? Like what's going on there? It's like, oh, Diane, you suck. You go like sit in like my bed now and I get your bed. Really yeah. wasn't clear what was going on with that either. Because she seemed like fine then, or not like fine, but like she right. seemed like she was like not catatonic or not in like a weird, you know, comatose or any, you know what I mean? It seemed like her eyes were open. She was aware of what was going on.
Yeah, but she's still kind of, I mean, yes, I think she was aware of what was going on, but I think in a way it was worse, because I think she was aware of what was going on, but somehow the situation was worse for her, because like the fact that she's kind of teary-eyed and she's like, Mavis, like it sounds like she's like sort of tortured in saying this, and Mavis is like, oh, she's fine, like talking to her family.
Kids.
Yeah, so it's definitely a different position than when CD enters the home, where she's like, oh, you know, don't disturb her, we can't touch her stuff. And then at the end of that, yeah, Mavis is using all the glasses and she's like mm-hmm. more jovial and she's like, yeah, she's fine. And so, yeah, I definitely got kind of like, yay for Mavis, but I kind of, and for CD, but I kind of got an ominous vibe for Diane. Like, uh-oh, Diane's not getting something good. I don't know what she was getting before either. Right. I mean, unless she was like walking around like healthy, because we kept seeing those close-ups of her image younger. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. I feel like maybe if we had seen, did I miss it? Did we see her walking around and I missed it? Because I don't think so.
I mean, there was that part where she got like knocked out of bed and like the struggle right. and she like stood up. But that seemed like it was like weird.
Yeah.
Deranged energy.
Right. that seemed like hallucination. Like,
yeah.
Ghost stuff. Not ghost stuff, but you know.
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I feel like if we had seen her walking around younger, I would have been like, oh, okay. So she's absorbing the souls of black people, which is really creepy. And, but it would have been a little clearer, but yeah, but I think I don't know. I think sort of that's what's happening. Anyway,
I'm glad we're both equally confused by this movie. Because it would have felt like really dumb if we came in here and like you're like, oh, I understood all of this, and like I can't believe you didn't like get all this.
No, like I said, I got vibes that it was going for, and I think I know what it's doing. But yeah, no, I wasn't 100% sure. The only thing I knew for sure was that CD was free. Because she's taken off the maid uniform and she's walking out of the gates with her daughter. Mm-hmm. She's like, I'm out of here.
And then the lady who was jogging actually waved to her.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Yeah. So clearly she's not under the spell of that house anymore. Mm-hmm. But yeah, but there are definitely some confusing parts. But for me, even the confusing parts, I found really interesting. I wish you had liked it more. I'm sorry you didn't.
Yeah, me too. It seemed like it was going to be like up my alley. And I really did like the social commentary aspects. Like one of the things that I forgot to mention before is that I loved how in this like white woman's house, it's like they're clearly making the statement on this like appropriated African art everywhere. Yes. Just like these, you know, busts and like all kinds of just like very like... it's like this is like vivid African art in this white woman's house.
Yeah. Well, also in that picture that we keep seeing of her younger, she's wearing African garb too.
Oh, I didn't even realize that.
Yeah. Yeah. Or that's the impression I got that it was supposed to be styled that way. Cause it's like, I don't know the exact word for the term, but it's not like a caftan per se, but it's like, it's kind of like a shirt dress, but not a shirt dress because people of all genders wear them. Not that dresses are gendered, but I digress. Right. But yeah, but I got that vibe. I was like, oh, she's got all this African art, you know, all of these sculptures and busts, like you said, and Egyptian like hieroglyphics on the wall. And she's also wearing African garb, like in her, you know, traditional African clothing, like in her photo too. So yeah, it was very appropriative. And gross. So yes, very much. I like that too. But I like that it's not really commented on. Like it's there. Mm-hmm. It's in the ether. Like you're definitely supposed to pick up on it. But I like that. I kind of like that it's not subtle, but it's also not hammering over the head. Like, hey, look at this, look at this. But like it is just in the visuals. Like you can't escape it. Anyway,
right.
It was great.
There's a lot of those shots of it just kind of like edited into moments of the movie. Just like randomly cut away to some of the artwork.
Yeah, no, I think that was really well done. Yeah, good production design.
All right. Was there anything else we wanted to talk about with Good Madam? Or should we move on to Don't Make Me Go?
The only last thing I will say is that on the poster for Good Madam, you know, it's CD and then a white hand over her mouth. And so I saw that. But I was still shocked when it happened in the film when she's like dragged like under the bed, and like the hand goes over her mouth. Yeah, it's a good tense scene. Anyway.
I think anytime in a horror movie when someone you think does not have the strength to stand up and do things and then does, you're like, whoa, okay.
Yeah. What's happening? Yeah. Oh, and then that mouth, the mouth of like, not ghost Diane, but like demon Diane, when she had like a giant, hole.
Ooh. Like, whoa.
Yep. Yeah, that was gross. It was good. A lot of mouth stuff happening. A lot of hands and mouth stuff happening in this film.
a lot of hand and mouth stuff.
Yeah. Oh, that reminded me. There is something else I wanted to say. I wanted to say this ages ago, and then I forgot. When you were talking about the hand stuff before, and you said something like what was going on there, I think this might be too basic, but I think it had to do with the fact of the body horror kind of connects to the fact of the servitude and how Black people catered to white people in this classist, apartheid, racist society. So anyway, to me, it made a lot of sense that there was a lot of gross things happening with the body because it was kind of connecting to the dehumanization of racism and classism. So anyway. Mm-hmm. I dug it.
Makes sense. I wish I dug it.
Me too. But, you know, what are you going to do?
Yep. Can't win them all. All right.
That is true.
Let's move on to Don't Make Me Go, which is directed by Hannah Marks and written by Vera Herbert. It is, oh boy, this premise here. I'm going to read the one sentence IMDb, or yes, it is one sentence. It's a long sentence. When a single father to a teenage daughter learns he has a fatal brain tumor, he takes her on a road trip to find the mother who abandoned her years before and to try to teach her everything she might need over the rest of her life. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I guess that covers the high points.
It covers the high points, but I don't think he taught her everything she needed to know for the rest of her life. But that's something we can debate.
No, we got some stuff to talk about with this movie.
Oh boy. Yeah.
Whoa,
yeah,
boy. When we finished it, I was like, well, that's a choice about a particular plot point that comes up late in the movie.
It's a ridiculously awful choice, but yes, we'll get in more into that, I'm sure.
Right. So John Cho plays Max, the father, and Mia Isaac plays Wally, the daughter, in this film. And I feel like we both wanted to see this because we both love John Cho. I mean, I think he's amazing. I think he's an amazing actor. Yes. He is he's so underappreciated, I think. And I loved him in Searching a few years ago. That was one of my favorite movies, and he was so great. And he just had to do so much with his face, and he's just, he's such an incredible actor. And I think he's incredible in this too. But should we fill in a little bit more of the plot?
Sure.
Yeah.
This plot is garbage, though.
Yeah. So Max, John Cho's character, finds out in the beginning. He's been having some headaches. He goes to the doctor. He finds out that he has, it's actually a tumor, a bone tumor that's like near his brain stem. And so they say to him, like, it's very likely that if we operate on this, you won't survive. Like, it's, they gave him like 20% chance of survival. So like really low odds. And so he's like, well, if I don't do that, then what do I got? And they're like, well, you got like a year. And he's like, oh shit. So yeah, he decides to take his daughter on a road trip that he tells her is to go to his college reunion. Was it 20th college reunion?
Yes.
Which is in New Orleans. They live in California. And so he drags her along on this road trip. And then, you know, meanwhile, she's like typical like teenager, you know, trying to, you know, date. And this shitty guy that's just like doesn't really pay attention to her / is like, you know, I don't want to be official and this and that. And
tries to have sex with her when she doesn't want to have sex. It's gross.
Yeah. And then later is like hounding her to send, you know, nude pics to him. Ugh. And it's just,
yeah,
it's,
he's gross. Terrible.
And so, yeah, father daughter road trip movie. And then eventually I think the most interesting things that this movie was doing up until the big, I don't know, call it a twist in air quotes before we get to it.
Oh, it's a twist.
Was making John Cho's character actually quite flawed. Like he's playing the like doting kind of strict father, and like, you know, he's saying things like, you know, she sneaks out to go to this guy Glenn's house and then calls the friend to pick her up, and the friend tells him that she was out and, you know, they were drinking, and he's like, well, I can't tell you not to see him, but like, you're grounded. And it's like, you know, there's all these moments where he's like very, you know, conservative, he's not a risk taker, and you know, there's this whole part where he like teaches her how to gamble by, you know, showing her how roulette works, or you know, saying like, oh, we won $350, but like, let's invest it, let's put in a retirement fund for you. Mm-hmm. And then you find out later that, you know, the mom, she left him, she abandoned, you know, her daughter, but it's like she left with his friend Dale. But she left with his friend Dale because he cheated on her first. And so, like,
that's,
I think
dumb.
That to me was like interesting, making him kind of like a flawed character, or someone who like did some shitty stuff, but then like didn't really lie about it so much as like leave out the shitty parts, like his shitty part of the equation, to his daughter. Like, not tell her the shitty things that he did that like influenced those you know, things that
happen. That's 100% a lie. First of all, omission is a lie. It's a lie by omission. And second of all, I think that is dumb. Like, not the fact that they made him flawed. I think that's great, because far too often in films, particularly Hollywood films, you know, and series two, it's like, oh, one person is terrible because they're a cheater. And no, okay, he was infidelitous too. But she abandoned her daughter. Like, it's gross. Like, there's something gross going on here. And like, and I don't feel like we get the whole story, because I don't think there is a whole story. But yeah, but the fact of when that he finally meets up with her mom, and she's very hard to find, and he finally finds her and finally, you know, finally kind of ambushes her. And but Wally, the daughter, rightfully says, like, no, you have to talk to her first. I'm not just going to like spring myself on her, which I think was very wise of her and very considerate.
Yeah.
But yeah, but he's like, don't you want to meet your daughter? And she's like, yeah, of course I do. And then, but she's like, but before that, she's like, I'm not fit to be a mother. Remember? That's what the courts say. But, and then she's also like hinting about how some other dude helped her to get her shit together. And I'm like, wait a minute. Was she like an alcoholic? Is she a drug addict? Like, what is happening here?
Right.
And we never really know. And it kind of just hints at it, which I'm fine with, but also I'm kind of bothered that, like, it's like, yeah, he's not great because he cheated too, but she abandoned the daughter. Like, I'm like, listen, if you're gonna make somebody abandon their kid, that's fine, that's a choice, but yeah, I don't know, it's got to be better than what that was. Anyway, I was highly irritated. But anyway, but carry on.
Right. So I thought that was interesting that they made him like a flawed guy. It wasn't just like the whole time he was like, you know, an angel and like the best dad ever, who was suddenly dying. I can't believe how long he waits to tell her.
Right.
Dying. And what? Then like she flips out, understandably, but like she jumps in the car and is like speeding, weaving in and out of traffic, and then like smashes the car. It's like, oh my God.
When she's been so scared and timid to drive the rest of the movie.
Right. Shall we get to the big twist of the movie?
Oh my fucking God, I guess so.
I mean, the fastest way to say it is they pull a real Fault in Our Stars on you. And it's just like, like, hey, guess what? The daughter died. And you're like, what?
Yeah.
Because she had a heart. An enlarged heart, we find out. She faints a couple of times or gets dizzy, and we don't put it together. It's like, bam, she's dead. Like, they're at a karaoke bar. And he's like, you know, she's convinced him to go proceed with the surgery, even though it's risky for a chance at survival. And then she collapses and dies. And she's giving his voiceover from beyond the grave.
Literally.
Yeah.
Literally. And she's like, I told you at the beginning of the movie you weren't gonna like this ending. And then she says blah 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 blah, and what do you expect from a dead girl? And I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? We're doing a narration from beyond the grave. Fucking bullshit. It was oh my God, it was so icky and manipulative. I was incensed. I was so pissed off. Like, we're already having one. It's a choice. We're already having one person on the verge of death. And now let's just throw in another thing, too, for shits and giggles. Like, why the hell not? Like, it's just, I can't. So this script was on the blacklist, and I cannot believe it was on the blacklist for most desirable screenplays, because I'm like, this is garbage. Like, I was pissed. Like, I was so outraged. But I will tell you that John Cho is, I think, this film's saving grace. I think he is, as always, giving an outstanding, stellar performance, because he is wonderful and the best. And I love him.
Yeah, he's great. He gives a fantastic performance. I don't know if I like the chemistry between him and Mia Isaac. There are moments where I don't feel like they're believable as father and daughter. It seems like they're like acting in different rooms or something. Like, they're just like, they
I
just
agree with
don't,
you.
They're saying the things that the father and daughter are written to say, but it doesn't feel like they're people who are actually relating to each other.
No, they felt very much They felt very, I think you nailed it when you're like, they're acting in different rooms. It's kind of like, but that's the funny thing. Like I was going to say, it's kind of like how voice actors are often recording in different rooms, but yet there mm-hmm. are voice actors who have much better chemistry in separate rooms than they did in the same room. But I think there are moments that work like between them as far as their chemistry yeah. goes. Like the mm-hmm. the confrontation scene after the car crash, I think that actually works. Like, I think Mia Isaacs is really good in that scene. And I mm-hmm. think her performance is kind of uneven the rest of the time. But that scene when she's like losing it and she's kind of screaming at times, but other times she's crying, she's kind of all over the place. But her all over the place works in that scene really well. And mm-hmm. I think John Cho and her are kind of on the same page. The other scene that I loved is the karaoke scene. I think that's lovely. And then it had to be ruined by her passing out and dying. But like before mm-hmm. that happened, I loved that karaoke scene. And by the way, that really is John Cho singing. And I was very excited about that. So
he's great.
I know. I shouldn't be surprised because I swear to God, every actor can also sing and can also dance. And like, they're all amazing. How are these people all so talented? But yes, I want to hear more John Cho singing, but apparently in a Q&A, I read this in an article that in a Q&A, somebody asked him, I think when it was at, when this premiered at Tribeca, somebody asked, was that really you singing? And he's like, yes, it was. And he was like really excited about it. So anyway, but yeah, he is great. But I agree with you. I think their rapport is uneven. And I think this writing is uneven. I think this direction is uneven. I think this film is uneven. Mm-hmm. I think it's all over the place. But I will say, I love a road trip film. I think this film works the best when it's focusing on their relationship, which seems kind of obvious. If you haven't seen the film yet, you're like, well, that's what this film is about.
Right.
But there's so much about her and this dumb guy, Glenn. And then right. there's so much about him and Kaya Scodelario, who's playing his much younger, not girlfriend, but the woman he's hooking up with, Annie. And, you know, mm-hmm. will they or won't they become more serious? Right. And I really don't care. But like, yeah. there's so much of that shit. And then there's the college reunion and then there's the looking for the mom. And I don't care about any of that actually. But what I did find the most interesting and when I think the film works its best is when it's focusing on the two of them, like kind of when they're bickering or when they're having a good time or what have mm-hmm. you. But back to the premise and him giving her all kinds of life advice. The only life advice he gives her is don't date a guy if he won't take you dancing. Like, and that's not bad advice, but I'm like, that's not all the life advice to give someone either.
Right. Which also is, but it's like the, like, don't date a dick.
Yeah. Which I mean, is just important,
like,
advice.
Like, date someone who actually gets you and appreciates you. And he's, he has that line about like, you have a fire inside you and like life is going to throw things at you. That's going to try to put that out. And I want somebody for you who is there. That's going to help it reignite that flame, who's there like trying to light the flame along with you. And so I think there's some other stuff that he's saying in there that I think is good advice, but otherwise there's the casino scene where he's teaching her about gambling, and there is that weird bit where he's like, and you know, so you don't wake up with snake eye tattoo on your ass or whatever. And I was like, I thought that was just some random thing. You know, like when people are making jokes and they're just like, what's the most absurd thing I can say right now? And they say it. And then they're like, oh yeah, that's how he got that snake eye tattoo on his ass in Vegas. And I was like, wait, that's a real thing? His character is supposed to have that? It's not just a weird joke that he told earlier.
No. I mean, and that is the thing. Like, you know, he is so conservative and in his look and in his behavior. And then we find out, that he has a snake eye tattoo on his ass and that he was, you know, in a band and he sang and played guitar and he thought he was going to be successful, but he gave it all up to be a dad. And there is something kind of interesting happening there about, do you need to sacrifice your risky dreams for your child? I don't know that it actually pulls it off, though, but and it still is really mm-hmm. icky and creepy to me thinking like, the dead daughter is narrating that she inspired him to take more chances. I'm like,
yeah, that was really awkward at the end there. Like, he'll probably never get over it. Yeah, of course he will never get over it. His daughter died.
Right. But like, we don't even get a chance to really see him mourning other than a moment at the cemetery. It's weird. It's just weird. Yeah. It's really
and
weird.
Then,
Her
mom is there and he's like, peace. I'm not going to talk to you.
No,
just cry by yourself.
I know. It's so weird. It's just really weird. I think what makes it worse is that the ending is basically a giant montage. And you didn't earn that montage. So, you know, fuck you. You don't get that montage. You did not earn it. Nope. So it makes me more irritated that we don't even see him grapple with her loss. We don't, and not that we need a protracted, like, drawn out thing, but like, we don't even really see it. It's just like, oh, well, she's dead. Oh, well, I have my surgery. Oh, well, now I'm in a long-term relationship. Okay.
Yeah.
Yay.
We're learning French because I forgot she was a French teacher.
Right. And now we're going to look at the meteor shower because that's what Wally wanted to do. Oh, Jesus Christ. I will say, though, that again, and this rests on John Cho's shoulders because he is so excellent. The scene where he's saying, I'm going to teach you to dance because every father should teach their daughter to dance before their wedding day. And she's like, Dad, we have tons of time. And there's a look on his face that is so pained and so bittersweet. It gutted me. And I was like, oh, it's so good. Cause he's so good. He's wonderful. And then there's another little moment in the karaoke scene where he doesn't wink at her, but he points to her because she picked the song that they both kind of bonded over, the Iggy Pop Passenger song. And I like that. It's like those little touches that make a character feel real, feel like an actual person. And John Cho is doing that because John Cho is so goddamn good. Oh my God. Why he is not a bigger star, I will never understand. Well, I know why. It's racism, but I mean, it's racism, let's be clear. But still, why he's not a bigger star, I'll never know. Because yes, Searching, that was my favorite male performance of that year. One of my favorite performances. And also Columbus, he's so good. I just love him.
He's really great. But I agree with you. I think the movie is, although I do also love a road trip movie. We've talked about road trip movies many times on the show. We've talked about our mutual admiration for them.
Yes.
A lot of the beats throughout the road trip feel very cliche, which definitely bothered me. However, I did appreciate the moments that were focused on their relationship. And I'm thinking of that scene where they are actually talking about that Iggy Pop song and she's wearing some like weird like sunglasses. And she's like, one of them says like, who even are you?
Oh yeah. He says that to her. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, that to me felt like it felt like a genuine moment between these characters, and they felt comfortable in their element. And it was a time where they felt like they had chemistry. They had father-daughter chemistry, and it felt real. It felt fun to watch these two characters get to know each other better. And so I agree. Long story short, I agree that the movie is best when it's focusing on their relationship and them like learning things about each other. And a lot of it is her learning stuff about him that she didn't know. But I like that. I like seeing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I mean, you never really, if you have a relationship with your parents, if they're in your life, you never really know your parents, you know? Like, I mean, because they're people too. And they were people, complicated people before, you know, they had you, and you don't really fully know them, even if you think you know them. So I do think the film does that well. And that's why I'm so annoyed and frustrated because this is such a bittersweet film, but it's also so uneven. It's just all over the place. Mm-hmm. And it's annoying to me because it could have, and I feel like should have been way better consistently. But yes, those moments, I agree with you. I wish it had just been more streamlined and focused on their relationship and learning more and hearing more advice. Like, I want more advice. Teach me all your ways, John Cho. Yeah. Oh, I love John Cho. He's so great.
He is. He's great. All right. Was there anything else that you want to talk about? I'm just trying to think if there's any ground we haven't covered. Oh, man. Oh, the nude beach scene. That was fucking weird.
Well, not only is it's weird that the film opens that way and then we circle back to it.
Right. Right. Because, you know, after some shit's gone down with, you know, her not meeting her mom, then he's like, I don't know, I just threw it in the GPS, the first beach I could find, because I know you like the beach or whatever. And it's like,
God.
All right. I'm like, why? I don't know why we need to see people at the nude beach. And like, also then we gotta like make a joke about their nude bodies. Like, she turns and sees the man and the woman that are like naked. I'm like, okay, all right, that's an eyeful for somebody, I guess, but like they're just naked people. Like, what? Like, why do we need to make them the butt of our joke?
Yes, although I would say as a 15-year-old kid, seeing, you know, naked old men, naked penises might be jarring.
Well, no, of course it is. But I'm just like, I don't know why that's where we had to go.
No,
like,
I don't either. It
we
was
have to like
really...
the camera has to pan so we could see their full naked bodies as she sees them. Like, because in the beginning, it's kind of like we see naked bodies, but we don't actually really see anything.
That's true.
But then it's
that's
like
true.
All of a sudden we have to like twice see this man and this woman
full
like
frontal.
Fully nude. Yeah.
Also, did you notice that the sound changes and the score changes, so it sounds like a horror movie?
No, I didn't notice that. Yes.
Not a full-on horror movie, but definitely more ominous than it was the first time. Yeah, I don't understand that either. It's as much as I love this subgenre, and I know you love it too, there are sometimes things that happen in road trip films and I'm like, why? Why did you need... It's just ridiculous and absurd for just absurdity's sake. And I feel like mm-hmm. that's what this was doing too. And so I guess it's a trope of road trip films. But yes, why did we have to be ageist about people's bodies?
Right. Like,
just let people be alone on their nude beaches.
Exactly. I almost feel like it's kind of just like a cliche in life around road trips. When people go on road trips, they always have like some crazy story they come back with. Like sometimes it's like a weird like tourist trap. Like, oh my God, I can't believe I paid like $20 to see that fucking huge ball of yarn. But then like other times it's like, oh, remember when so-and-so like fell in the hole by the side of the road? You know what I mean? It's like, I feel like there's always like in life when people go on road trips, they always have like one really absurd story. So maybe that's what this was trying to do. It was like, all right, maybe. Our one absurd story is that like a well-intentioned dad was like, oh, I accidentally brought my daughter to a nude beach.
Yeah. I think I'm going on the wrong road trips, though. I don't think I have any weird stories like that. I clearly need better, more spicy road trips. But yeah, but I think you're right. But it's just, I don't know. I don't think we needed to see it twice. I don't think it needed to start the film. It's some weird editing choices. Very weird.
Very strange. Don't know why they did it that way. Don't know why we had to see it and then see it again.
Right? Wasn't once enough. So weird. This movie definitely makes some bizarre choices.
Oh, for sure. Like I was so surprised when they killed her and not him. I'm still like thinking about it because I watched the movie earlier today. It was like still just so strange to me that was the direction they went.
Yeah. 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 Anyway, I don't know. I was pissed. I'm still pissed about it.
Oh, man. This movie.
Yeah. That really sums it up, doesn't it? Oh man, this movie.
All right. So let's do a quick recap. We only had two movies, so it shouldn't be too hard. All right. So there's Good Madam, which is going to be available on Shudder. See it or don't see it?
I would say see it.
I'm gonna say nay on this one just because I've had it so slow. So slow, and I don't feel like it paid off in the end, but I liked its ideas.
Ditto. Just about the ideas, I mean. I liked more than you.
And Don't Make Me Go. Oh boy.
God, I know. I'm like dreading this. I don't know. Part of me is like, no, I don't want to recommend this, and I don't recommend it.
Yeah.
But also I love John Cho. There are better John Cho movies. Let's just put it out there. There are a million better John Cho movies to see. But if you are a John Cho completionist, and I can't say I blame you because he's amazing, then I would say see it. Otherwise, don't. I don't know.
Yeah, otherwise I would say ridiculous. It's a big skip.
Yeah. Actually, yeah. 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 Really just see it for John Cho because, yes, otherwise it's... I think it's, yeah. Oh my God, that ending is torturous. Anyway.
Yeah. And anyway, this
scarred
movie's gonna be
by
available.
That ending.
Yeah. And this movie's going to be available on Amazon if you so choose to watch it. Be on Amazon Prime. So I think that wraps up this week's episode of Spoiler Piece Theater. We want to say a huge thank you, as always, to our editor, Otto Klammer. Otto, thank you so much for making us sound great week after week.
Thank you, Otto. We love you.
You're the best. You can find the show anywhere you get podcasts, but you can also find us at our website, which is spoilerpiece.com. We're all over social media. We're Spoiler Piece Theater on Facebook. We're at Spoiler Piece on Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, and TikTok. And you can email us if you want to get in touch with us. You can tell me I'm wrong about Good Madam, or we can all just kind of gripe about Don't Make Me Go.
Oh, boy.
Or maybe there's something totally brilliant about the movie that we missed. But you can email us, spoilerpiece@gmail.com, or you can give us a call
at 862-21-PIECE.
You can leave us a message and tell us we're totally wrong and Don't Make Me Go is an amazing movie.
Except we're not wrong. But John Cho is
amazing. I'd love to hear your case on that, listeners. If that's the case you're making, I would love to hear it.
I actually would too. I'm intrigued.
Yeah. If you like the show, please rate and review us. You can go to ratethispodcast.com/spoilerpiece, and that will take you to your platform of choice. We really appreciate any ratings. Helps more people find the show. Gives us some street cred in the podcast world. And if you really, really like the show, please consider joining our Patreon. This week's exclusive audio, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we're talking about the 2010 Disney animated film Tangled, and that was a fun discussion. You know, when you join our Patreon, you can get access to bonus content that we release every week, 200 plus bonus episodes, you can vote in polls, and all kinds of fun stuff. So yeah, that does it for this week's episode. My name is Evan Crean. I'm co-chair of the Boston Online Film Critics Association and co-author of your 80s movie guide, The Better Living. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd as Real Recon, and that's real as in film reel.
And my name is Megan Kearns. I write film reviews for Edge Media Network. I, too, am a member of the Boston Online Film Critics Association. You can follow me on Twitter at OpinionSWorld or on Instagram and Letterboxd at TheOpinionS.
We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.